Lectionary Lab Live is recorded by Two Bubbas and a Bible live from Gainesville, Florida and Brasstown, North Carolina. Welcome, everybody, to the Lectionary Lab Live. I'm John Fairless. I'm here with my Bubba, Delmer Chilton. Say hey, Bubba.
Hey, Bubba.
Hey, man. It's always good to hear you. I look forward to getting together each week, talk a little text, think about preaching. We're going to today be considering the third Sunday after Pentecost. These are the texts for June the 10th, 2018. Tell me what you got going on, Bubba, in terms of laying the text out. Just a reminder, we talked about it last week with the shift to ordinary time. We have expanded options for text, total of six texts. They sort of lay out along a couple of tracks, maybe three. You could kind of put, three or so ideas out there about how these texts are grouped.
Right.
What is it they used to give on the shows with stunts and real life action? The disclaimer: do not try this at home.
Yeah.
Do not try to preach all six texts in one sermon.
No. I had a person I knew one time that their basic, they figured they had 10 to 12 minutes to preach, and they just got up and read out the four lessons, regular lessons, and then they spent 2 minutes on each text and then a summary of what they thought all of that meant together. That was their sermon. And it was not particularly edifying. I'm sure God was glorified in the attempt to worship.
Yeah.
Don't try that.
The time was filled. That's one thing we can say about that. Yeah. Tell me what you're thinking, Bubba. I sort of lay out the pathway for us here and then let's walk and talk our way through it.
Well, I think if you want to divide this out by kind of themes or things that hang together, the first thing, there are three basic routes. The first one is the semi-continuous with Samuel and it's tied with commentary Psalm 138.
Right.
The second one is tied to the gospel, as usual, with Mark, the gospel story there with Genesis commenting on that and the Psalm complementing that, Psalm 130. And then the last track or the other track is that continuous preaching our way through 2 Corinthians mm-hmm. and that text. So what I would like to do is just take them in order as they come, as you read them. If you read the semi-continuous Hebrew scriptures lesson, then you're in Samuel with Psalm 138. Great story here. I've always liked this story. This story has, and part of it's just my personal kind of libertarian politics that I like the description of what government, as they say where I grew up in Western North Carolina, government, what government will do to you.
Yeah.
This great analysis of that. It's an interesting story. It's a prelude to the whole stories of the kings. This is kind of one of those foreshadowing pieces. So if you're going to preach this summer, remember you're going to be Saul and David and Absalom, and it's kind of like this great storyline about the upper crust and the royal family. This is prelude to that and kind of a warning. It's interesting. This is what you're going to get. And then they got it.
And there you go.
There you are. A couple of themes for me, and then you talk a little bit. One is this whole question of rejection. It's interesting, when people came to Samuel and said, "We want a king," he immediately felt rejected and upset. They don't like my leadership anymore. They've been transitioning from the judges, and he was a judge and a prophet. Samuel goes and prays to God and says, "They're rejecting me." And God comes to him in that prayer time and says, "No, they're not rejecting you. They're rejecting me, God, as their king." Now, what he's saying, this is the first place in Hebrew scriptures in which we find this notion of our king is not like other kings because he says they are rejecting me as their king. This is not exactly a theocracy notion that Hebrew mm-hmm. scriptures has. It's more one that the king leads in God's stead and is a shepherd of the people. And what the dynamic through most of Samuel for me is this going back and forth about what is a king. One of the great stories of Hebrew scriptures is what is the role of a king within Israel? Is not God, like, you know, these other places think of him as God, and it's not all, he doesn't have all power. Even David gets called to account by the prophet. So this is the beginning of a dialogue with Israel's history by the writers of this about defining what it means to be a people chosen by God with leadership, and what is a leadership's role within that whole rejection, in what ways. And so the question for us, that's several thousand years ago, the question for us, when we look at that, there's questions of what is the role of religion in public life that could be addressed here. There are questions of what parts of our life do we reject God's leadership and why? Why do we reject it? And I think most questions of this nature have to do with security versus freedom. We give up freedom for increased security, which is reflected in this text when you get to the part where it says we want a king that will fight our battles for us. So you've got this whole list of things that the king will take from you, and they say, nonetheless, we want that because we want someone to fight our battles for us. And, you know, politically, I think one of the debates we've had since 9/11 with Homeland Security is how much freedom do we give up for increased security?
Right.
How much do we give away to the, you know, how much do we give away and how much does the government take of our individual freedoms in the name of national security? Mm-hmm. That goes all the way back to this dialogue when Israel wants a king. You know, and no matter what the historicity of the story is, the truth of it is this has always been the problem. This has always been the discussion, and I think this is a good place to look for it. And the tie to Psalm 138, and I'm going to let you roll here, is verse 4, all the kings of the earth shall praise you, O Lord, this tying in to the notion of kingship with this question, we want a king.
Yeah. I think that is interesting to note and important to note. This is the development of, in the thought of Israel, the Melech HaOlam, the king of the universe, which becomes the most common vision of God in Judaism. God is the king of the universe, deserves our worship and our praise, and God is the one in whom we place our trust. If you are reading and working from the Samuel text throughout the summer, I think it's important to understand what we are seeing is a season of growth and of change. Things are shifting in the life of the nation, both as a nation and as a cult. And I use that in the best sense of the word, the cultus, the worship that was central to the life of Israel. There are concerns about the future, and there's worry, there's wondering. Are we going to be okay? What's going to happen to us? And in this particular setting for today, it's really undeniable that change needs to happen. They're right. The leaders are right when they come to Samuel with the situation. Look, you're old, and your sons are not going to be able to take over for you. We're worried, Samuel, and something has got to happen. Something has got to change. Well, that's true. All of that is true. And I think as much as we have to realize it, we generally don't like change. They didn't really either. There's an anxiety level going up here. And yet change has to happen, and it will. I think the issue comes over the decision they've already made. We've already decided what we need to do. And there's a break with the continuity of the past. Not only did they not ask Samuel what he thought, they did not do as Samuel had taught them. Well, you know, maybe we'd best pray about this first. Maybe we better think about what God wants. And the change here early on becomes they change the way they're operating. They make a choice. There's so many connections. It doesn't matter if this story is 3,000 years old. There's so many connections
right.
with where we live, we are constantly choosing how to respond. We're choosing our response to a life that is changing all the time, a world that is shifting rapidly. I can remember when I was growing up and I would hear my parents and my grandparents talking about how much the world had changed. And I'm thinking, oh, y'all just a bunch of old fuddy-duddies. You can't keep up. And now I'm realizing there's so many things going on, I can't keep up. I'm the fuddy-duddy. Well, I can get anxious about that. I can wonder about that. But at the end of the day, the question becomes, and I believe it's the great question of Scripture, who and what do you trust? And to take it even further, to quote our friend we've used a lot, my former professor at Vanderbilt, Liston Mills, life's ultimate question really is, can God be trusted? And that's why God's counsel to Samuel is, Samuel, they're not rejecting you. This is not about you. This is about a choice these folks are making. And so every choice comes with a cost. Every decision does. Everything does. And this passage, as much as any, makes it explicit. God has Samuel tell them, okay, go ahead and get a king. It's cool. I'm cool with that. But let me tell you what it's going to cost, what you really are giving up. And as you point out at the end, they say, that's fine. We want to feel more secure. We want a king like everybody else has got one, so we'll pay it.
Yep.
Well, we'll wait. And that's a theme that's going to come up throughout this series as well, not only on the part of the people, facing change, facing a future, having to decide who and what and where do we place our trust. Leadership is going to come up with that over and over again. And what are the choices? What are the costs that yep. come with the choices leadership makes? And that's going to become sharply focused in the life of David, as you point out. So just a couple of things to keep in mind as you're working your way through these texts throughout the summer. It really is that overview of, yes, things are changing. It's not that change is bad. It's actually necessary. What does the future hold? And who and what will you trust? Where will you place your trust? And for those of us who are trying to make some kind of claim to be people of faith, can God be trusted with all these details of my life? So, yeah.
One other thought is that another way of approaching this in terms of, I talked a little bit about national or other security, you know, congregationally, when you start thinking about what do we need to be doing and looking around and saying what other people are doing, mm-hmm. that's another anxiety, security, and freedom kind of things. The church, this big church over there is having this program. This church is having that program. That one's having that one. We need to be like them mm-hmm. in order to be okay. And there may be things you can learn from them. I'm not saying not. I'm saying, but you have to look at your congregation,
your place,
your ministry, the people in your pews at this point as the who God has gifted to be there, and your pastor and whatever leadership, you got to look at that mm-hmm. and look and be careful what you take from somebody else. We don't necessarily need to be like other people. We need to be like the people God has called us to be.
Yeah. One right. can make a case when we get to the gospel, and that'll transition us, not necessarily to this gospel reading today right. per se, but when one comes to the gospel, I think there's a pretty strong argument. We are not like the other nations, the other people, right. God's people. There's something distinctive about belonging to God and about belonging to Christ. What is that for us? And that's how we peel back the layers of the gospel message, which you are prepared to do, no doubt, skillfully.
Some of which.
Yeah.
Some of
which. How about it?
Well, you know, I cannot hear this lesson today without two things coming to mind. The toward the end of the lesson, when the family comes, you know, it starts with the family and then he's talking and then you end up with the family. And I'm a good Southern boy, and I always hear that with his mama Nim.
Your mama Nim are out here.
Your mama and them are out here. Yeah. How's your mama and them? And I've wondered about that. I mean, this is some of the side why we say mama and not daddy. But we are a matriarchal society. We may as well admit it.
Here in the South, you're right.
Here in the South, we're a matriarchal society and mamas. So in this story today, Jesus' mama and them, his family, extended family, come because they've heard he's, quote, out of his mind. And then you have this whole business of he has the ruler of the demons in him. And it goes on to the house divided. Those of us who grew up studying American history a bit immediately think of Abraham Lincoln. I think I heard that line in history class before I ever read it in the Bible.
Right.
You know, and in 1858, whatever, Lincoln debate with Stephen Douglas leading up towards, so they were, he was running for senator in Illinois, but became a famous series of debates. And one of his, a house divided against itself cannot stand. He was really trying to run on, we've got to resolve this issue. A house divided against itself cannot stand. North, South, slavery, et cetera. It became a famous, that's how he got lifted up into the national awareness and became president a couple of years later, was the speeches around that issue. So Jesus makes use of that of saying, you can't call me Satan if I'm healing. You know, he makes a very logical case. The devil is not... diseases of the devil, the devil's not going around healing, so it's illogical to call me the devil if I'm healing.
The devil ain't got no interest in folks being healed.
Exactly. Yeah. So and then I want, and so this is one of the arguments he makes. So there's one, a house divided against itself. He said, I'm not of the devil's house, I'm of God's house, and I'm not a divided against myself, I'm against the evil and for good. Then you have the whole family situation coming where his, as we say, his mom and them come and say, your family's out here and they're worried about you. And he makes this division that it's so hard for most of us to embrace, which in which he says, who is my family?
Mm-hmm.
You know, who are my mother and my brothers? Whenever people are talking about biblical family values and standing up for the family, I want to know if they've read this part.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I can say Jesus on the cross looks down and takes care of his mother. His mother's always there. It wasn't like he rejected her, but he was saying there's a higher calling than the biological. There's a higher calling, and God comes to separate us from some of our traditional relationships in order to call us to a higher one. This is a difficult place, and the house divided against itself. My goodness, you know, who's on whose side to choose a side? I mean, all the dynamics within this text that come down to a really serious question of what does it mean for the kingdom of God to come and claim us? What does it mean to move in that direction? Before we expand much more on that, I want to say, why then is this Genesis text tied to this, which is the story of original sin? And the easy answer there is, well, you got the serpent. You know, you got the serpent, and that's Satan, and so that's the easy answer. But a more interesting answer is that the coming of the kingdom of God is designed to fix what happened in Genesis. That's the Christian understanding of this. Mm-hmm. And it's a very rough dynamic in which they're accusing him of being involved with Satan. And he's really saying, no, I'm the opposite of that. I'm putting this back together. And it came to mind with Adam and Eve, the first couple. What is that line in weddings? And Lutheran liturgy is a little different than wedding liturgy, so I don't remember it exactly. What that which God hath put together, let no man put asunder. Isn't that the way it goes?
Mm-hmm.
I know that more from movies than from our wedding liturgy. I would argue that this text is telling us what humanity has torn asunder, only God can put back together.
Right.
And part of the problem is for our tearing asunder is looking to security. It might a little bit of a tie back to Samuel in this torn asunderness that we live in, this state of sin where everybody's against one. We look for affiliations where we feel secure. You can extend family to being our ethnicity, our national borders, people who think like us. I'm Republican, you're Democrat, red and blue. We keep dividing out into very antagonistic groups. Who's in my family and who's not?
Right.
For security. Most of this comes down when people are yelling at each other. I saw something the other day that talks about how conservatives think liberals are stupid and liberals think conservatives are mean. And we get, how can you think that? You're mean. You don't want to. And the truth underneath both of it is both of us want a secure and healthy world.
Well, that's
and
it.
We have different ways of looking at it. This text, both the Genesis text of that I love that sin. And when God comes and confronts Adam, he immediately points to the woman who points to the serpent. We're always pointing fingers.
Mm-hmm. We had to point somewhere else.
Point somewhere else as to what the problem is. And we need to be looking ourselves in the mirror. But the other thing is this whole story in the gospel lesson then brings us back to this place where people are saying, here's your family. You're on this side. You're on that side. You should be with your family. And Jesus cuts through it all to define what the new humanity is that is the kingdom of God. Here are my mother and my brothers. Whoever does the will of God is my brother and sister and mother. That is, we are called into a new humanity that isn't divided against itself. Mm-hmm. It's God's people, and all are included. That's the dynamic he works us through here.
Centered on this evocative phrase, the will of God. Whoever does the will of God is my brother, my sister, my mother. This is the family. And I gotta think there's some fertile exploration to be done here.
Yep.
Between doing the will of God, which we often want to treat as being elusive and, that's too high for me and I can't figure that out. And as you spoke of a show or two ago, the cartoon with the guy laying there with his Bible, Lord, if you would just show me, just give me a hint of your will. But how it's tied to the theme that runs through all of these stories about our tendency to abdicate responsibility.
Yeah.
What were the people in Samuel's time saying, really? We don't want to be responsible anymore. Give us a king, somebody to fight the battle. We don't care what it costs. It's an abdication of responsibility. What is it that's going on here in the Genesis story? What's really sin here? Why did you hide? Who told you you were naked? Well, she said, he did, that thing did. Abdication of responsibility. And even as we start to get into this gospel text, this guy, we can explain him. He's working for the devil. They're abdicating their own responsibility to make a decision about Jesus and why he's come. Let me put it over here. Let me do this. And as you say, when you come down to the end of it, Jesus says, look, let me break it down for you. Let me make it simple. You can tell who's in the family. Where's the will of God? The will of God at the center? And again, we may say, well, how can you tell what the will of God is? And as one of my mentors, pastor, said years ago, he's given you 10 commandments. How are you doing with those?
Yeah.
Never a bad place to start.
So, you start with the Ten Commandments, Jesus' commentary thereon, the Sermon on the Mount.
And loving God, loving your neighbor as yourself. I mean, there's a lot of ways. I'm just sort of pointing out here, there's a lot of walking around room in here for us to think about as preachers. There's a lot of opportunities to interact and to enter the world of our listeners And as you've already said, that's got to be for your people and for your time and for your place. There's a lot of opportunity to do that here.
I'm spending a lot of time walking around this summer in Luther's lines about in his introduction to the Old Testament, in which he talked about faith and love being the mistresses, the controllers of the law.
Decision makers here.
The decision makers around the law. And it says that which does not serve faith and love is not to be obeyed. And faith being trust in God. So both of those are trusting and loving God and trusting and loving our brothers and sisters, our neighbors.
That's it.
And those are the core hermeneutic principles that you bring to every text and every sermon. What brings this community closer to trusting God and loving their neighbor?
Yeah.
What helps them know that to trust God and know they're loved by God and to love in turn their neighbor?
That's it. Well, you know, Bubba, I saw Herman down at the garage the other day. He didn't say nothing about no nudic. I don't know what you're talking about exactly there. And let me just say before we finish with the look at the epistle today, Delmer and I realize that when we get going and we get into bubble world a little bit, we start slinging around some of our southernisms and et cetera. Just to be clear, that is not Mama N M, Mama Nim. It's Mama and Them, or Mother and Them, them being primarily family and stuff. So that's Mama Nim.
Mama Nim equals Mother and all those whom she takes care of as extended family.
There you go. That's Mama Nim. Hey, we better move on now and finish up with a great text in Corinthians. Yeah.
Yeah, the one line, you know, the slight momentary affliction measured out in an eternal weight of glory beyond all measure. Every time I read that text, I remember C.S. Lewis preaching a sermon that can be found online during World War II at one of the Anglican churches in Oxford called The Weight of Glory. And he basically, and what I want to talk about has to do with how he ends up defining that. And he talks about the weight of glory is when you realize how much you are beloved by God. That's one weight of glory. Our glory is not in anything we do, it says. Our glory is not on being fine human beings. Our glory is not in Western civilization, which he points out we're currently in the midst of destroying. This was 1942. He said our glory is that we are made and loved by God. And then he said, and we have lots of present afflictions. Think about the present afflictions, slight momentary affliction. England was going through nightly bombings and all of that. You can look at Dunkirk and the movie on Churchill that's just come out. You can see what they were going through at that time. We have a lot of slight momentary affliction in the modern world as well. But we have the eternal weight of glory. But the issue of the weight. So if we suddenly realize that we are made in the image of God and we are loved by the creator, the king of the universe, the one who made all things loves and loves us, that's exciting. And then we look around and we realize that person we don't like, that person down the road, that person who needs us, that person who is dependent, they have the same glory. And the weight of glory is that we are called to love and serve them in the name of God. The weight of my brother and sister is definitely on my back. I remember the song, He Ain't Heavy, He's My Brother, from our 60s. I think he would say that's kind of where Lewis is going with this, that we are responsible for each other. We are. All those who do the will of God are my brother and sister and mother, and we are to care for Mama and them with all our hearts. That's what I have to say about that.
Yeah.
As another good Southerner would say.
And that's all I have to say about that.
I am transfixed by that phrase, preparing us for the weight of glory. And again, sort of musing in my own congregation, as I am primarily a worshiper these days, and so I get to sit and listen to some sermons, which I haven't been a long time since I've had much of a chance to do that. I enjoy listening to other preachers, and our associate pastor was helping us to consider sort of related to the weight of glory, the immensity of God's grace, and did a fine job of helping us explore a number of ways to think about that. But as I think of this, why must we be prepared for an eternal weight of glory? Part of what I see is how immeasurably and for us currently unimaginable the glory and the grace of God truly are. And I go to the hymn text, Charles Wesley, Love Divine, All Loves Excelling. And we get to his wonderful ending phrase, lost in wonder, love, and praise. To be lost in that. You know, some people say, well, does that mean when we get to heaven, all we're going to do is sit around and go to church? And I think that's a really cheapened version here. I just get this idea of our jaws absolutely dropping through eternity going, I can't believe this stuff. I can't believe the weight, the measure of this glory. And so we are being prepared for that now. And it's a relatively light affliction.
Yeah.
So, Buy, you talk about a lot to think about here and a lot to work with, folks. You got it this week. Despite our fall to roll and fooling around with our Bubba-isms from time to time. Bubba, I've appreciated it today.
Yep.
And we've walked a good path. Our thoughts and prayers and best wishes with all of you that'll be studying, preaching, proclaiming this week. And Bubba, I don't reckon there's much else for us to do today other than to tell everybody bye.
Everybody bye.
Lectionary Lab Live is a Two Bubbas and a Bible production. Our opening theme is Lock and Key by Silent Partner. We go out this session with A Change Is Gonna Do Me Good by the inimitable Etta James.
Tears run dry. I would give anything just to feel all right. Down on my knees, praying for help. But sometimes you just gotta help yourself. I tried so hard to be someone you would love. Seems I would never try hard enough. Though I love you, got to give you up. I'm going back to who I was. I do believe the change is gonna do me good. Let's take this moment to say goodbye. Look at each other right straight in the eye. Don't look back, baby, 'cause I'll be gone. I've got my own life to carry on. I hard enough. Though I love you, got to give you up. I'm going back to who I was. And I do believe change is gonna do me good. I'm going back to who I was.